Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and you are listening to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health, your hormones, your life in general. And as you know, if you've been listening to the show, this is an opportunity to have an in-depth conversation with people who really have a great deal of wisdom to share with us. And as always, this is a chance to just kind of kick back and have an open mind so you can continue to learn, grow, and heal. I also invite new listeners to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com. I've got lots of great information. Opt in there to my newsletter because you get some special reports. Go to my Facebook page. I post things on a daily basis of interest, of relevance, sometimes just fun, but it's all about giving more and more of that information out to you. So today is carrying on from the series that we've been talking about all month, and it's called my Wholehearted Health Series. So we're talking about our heart, we're talking about how to support our heart, how to create healthy cardiovascular system, and we're kind of expanding our understanding of the heart today to incorporate not just what the physical heart needs, but also our emotional heart and also our spiritual heart, because how we live in the world and how we relate in the world profoundly impacts how our heart functions. And the person who's going to take us on this journey today is the best person we can find to do this job because he is so experienced in his teachings and in his writings. I have as my guest today Dr. Stan Tatkins. He is the author of a wonderful audio series, and it also is part of his series he's been doing in his books. His audio series is called Your Brain Unloves, the Neurobiology of Healing Relationships. So Dr. Tatkins is a clinician, a researcher, teacher, and has a private practice in Southern California. He teaches and supervises family medicine residents at Kaiser Permanente and is an assistant clinical professor at UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine at the Department of Family Medicine. Dr. Tatkin and his wife, Tracy Bodman Tatkin, developed the Psychobiology Approach to Couple Therapy Institute to train clinicians to incorporate a fusion of attachment therapy, developmental neuroscience, and arousal regulation to treat couples. PACT, which is short for his psychobiological approach to couple therapy, we'll call it PACT from now on, is quickly gaining a reputation for effectively treating couples formerly thought of as untreatable. The PACT Institute hosts trainings in 7 U.S. cities as well as Australia, Canada, Spain, and Turkey. Dr. Tatkin's best-selling books include Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Diffuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship, and Love and More in Intimate Relationships, Connection, Disconnection, and Mutual Regulation in Couple Therapy. We're going to understand what all these words mean in just a very short moment or two. I first like to welcome Dr. Stan Tatkin to the show.
Hi, Cheryl. Don't you just love having to read words that are like that in long subtitles?
I just really hope I get, I say them correctly. Because, you just try to do your best to sound like you're congruent and just keep talking. But no one knows what I'm saying anyway, so that's why I can get away with it.
I think it's a mouthful, actually. I don't know that I could do it.
Well, thank you. I take it as a compliment. I can read well. I can read and verbalize at the same time.
Right.
Skill I've developed over the decades. this is a great conversation. I have a particular interest in the realm of relationships. I think it's really important for us to get clues and skills and resources and a context to put our relationship dynamics in, because we have been poorly trained in the realm of relationships. And if there's one area that we need training with so we can make the most of the promise and the gifts found in a intimate relationship or even a relationship with anyone, it really comes from learning skills. So this is your work. And I just want to say I've listened to your whole audio series.
Thank you.
Your Brain on Love. And I was very impressed. It had profound information that I think is powerfully relevant for everybody. So that's why I wanted you here. And I wanted you here also because as part of this Wholehearted Health Month, understanding relationships and how we deal with relationships profoundly impacts our physical heart, whether we're under stress or not. So let's just jump right off the edge here. And why don't you share with us your approach to relationships? What have you discovered in the work that you've been doing over these years?
Oh, golly, quite a bit. The psychobiological approach means that we're looking at people not just from a psychological point of view, from their people's history and thinking and the way they process information, but also from a developmental neurobiological place where we're interested in how brains work, how infant brains are developed, what is it about us that needs to pair bond, needs to feel tethered to another person, and then also what is it about us that has certain troubles, staying pair bonded beyond 4 years, where we would ordinarily procreate and then stay together to protect the baby, and then, our ancestors, then move on and mix up the gene pool. But now we live at a time where we live very long, and how do we manage these relationships that go on longer than those 4 years? And that's really what we're looking at three different areas. Attachment, in other words, how secure people feel from the earliest relationships onward. And in the nervous system, arousal, how people are able to manage each other in terms of their arousal, excitement, and relaxation. And then also what people are really good at socially, emotionally, and what people aren't so good at. And I would say everybody has some kind of talent, in the area of social emotional functioning. And just the same, we have certain areas where we're not so good. And so in this work, we're very interested in two brains operating together and how that often causes trouble.
And I think it's really important to, I hate to break it to my audience, but I feel like I must, and that is that there is no perfect relationship. I know it's really going to upset you for the day, but the fact of the matter is, if you're looking for that, prince or princess, that perfect relationship where that happy ever after, all those movies where they fall in love and get together, but they never kind of show you 5 years, 10 years down the track what happens to these couples in the movies, right? We have to understand that, but to have a relationship that is satisfying and fulfilling and to allow the full potential to blossom, we have to have skills. And unfortunately, this is where you come in, Stan, because no one really has been taught those skills.
Right. Well, let me speak to your point, because we have certain maxims in PACT. One of them is that there's nothing more difficult than another person. People are hard, and partners are especially hard. Harder, in fact, than children and pets, of course. And so that's one. Two is that all people are basically difficult and irritating and annoying, and that's just the way people are. When we take another person on in the sense that we marry them, or we're living with them, or we're dependent, interdependent with them, we take them as sort of our burden, and we're a burden as well. And so that's sort of the quid pro quo of these relationships, primary attachment, romantic relationships, is that, people are burdensome. That's just the way it goes. There really is no such thing as a low-maintenance person up close. People look low-maintenance from a distance, but if you marry them, you'll soon find that there is nobody who's low-maintenance. And so these things, I think, are important because we live in a culture where I think people don't find fault And they think that it's special somehow that they've discovered their partner is irritating. And yet that is what we know is going to happen. In fact, the things that I love most about you are the things that are going to bug me later on. It's sort of nature's little joke. And so I think it's important that people understand how relationships actually work and how we're very much really animals when it comes to interacting with each other as much as we'd like to think that we're not, we are. I think when people don't realize that or don't understand how the brain works and understand how two nervous systems really do interact, not knowing that really, I think, can be a deficit for people. In other words, knowing how the brain works and knowing how people actually operate only helps people in their relationships.
Well, you know, that's kind of depressing, isn't it?
It should be uplifting. No, it should be uplifting because there's a difference between being annoying and dangerous. See, we're concerned about threat.
Right.
When people are threatening to each other, and, of course, something annoying could turn into something threatening. I could be doing something over and over again that's annoying to you, and you could start to build a threat response to me because you could be thinking, why in the world would I continue to do this? If I know it makes you unhappy, I must be doing this purposely. So then we're concerned about these interactions that become threatening, and this is where often couples go off the rails. Here's a small T threat, you know, where the roll of my eyes or the sound of my voice or the words I'm using or the movement of my body means something to you, and it could mean something quite unfriendly. And then your face does something unfriendly and kind, and then we're off to the races.
And that is what happens in all relationships. And like you said, what most attracted you in the beginning usually becomes the thing that drives you crazy down the track.
Yes.
I want you to explain that. Why is that?
Help us
understand the nervous system and our reactions, because that's really what we're talking about here, right?
I think of that issue of, you know, that the things that we are attracted to most are become irritating is a matter of dosing. And dosing, you're talking like medicine dosing, how much of you I want. So I like it, but I don't like it in this dose, or I don't want it at this moment. I'd like it in the dosage I would like. And so we're really talking about amplitude and frequency and mood and the whole getting to know you thing. So in the beginning, of course, all of that's charming. And then when you start living with someone day to day, that then becomes less charming. And the reason for that also is because as we become dependent on each other, we start to rely on one another for regulation of our internal state. So if I get excited, hopefully you're somebody who doesn't get excited in a bad way at the same time I do. You're able to find a way to regulate me, calm me down. Or if I'm depressed, you are a kind of person who knows how to pick me up. We don't hit each other at the same moment where we're both drowning in the water at the same time. And so for those people who unfortunately do catch on fire at the same time, I'm mixing metaphors here, people who do get in trouble at the same time, there are certain skills learning how to handle work your partner. So there's ways out of these things, but we also have to understand that that we all have histories. We all come from a culture, a family culture, and the brain really operates by memory. In fact, 99% of our time is spent operating with procedural memory, memory that is automatic, and that that most of the time we don't really know what we're doing or why we're doing it. We're just doing it because it's familiar, because we recognize this as something we've seen before, done before. And this is how we run our lives, and this is how we operate in relationship. I begin to remember the way you look or how you sound. And that memory, I may not connect right away to something that happened when I was younger, but I will act right away as if I'm there, and I will do whatever is necessary to make me feel okay. This is the shoot first, ask questions later tactic. So we have a nervous system that's acting extremely fast, faster than thought, based on memory, which is operating most of the time. And so it's quite easy to understand how people could start to misunderstand each other, misappraise one another's cues, and start to think that that the other person is doing something purposely. And this is the mistakes that people just commonly make. Does that make sense?
Yes. No, it certainly makes sense to me. So why do we perceive, or why do you say the other person is innately difficult? What is it that creates that perception, and what do we need to do to heal it or have other ways, other resources to work with it so we keep our heart open?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, most of the time it's fine. People will say, about their partners, I don't have this problem with my siblings, or I don't have this problem with my coworkers or my friends. And of course, they're judging this based on their experience of other relationships. But if they were to marry their friends, they probably have problems too. The difference here has to do with the unique nature of a primary relationship, a romantic relationship, which has certain properties to it and follows certain guidelines and rules that other relationships don't. And this has to do, again, with our earliest relationships with our earliest caregivers. It has to do with dependency needs and safety and security and anticipation of what will happen when we depend on another person. So these relationships are unique. And because of that, because we're dealing with another human brain, which is enormously complex, in real time, we can't quite predict things. And so because we can't quite predict things, we look for signs of recognition, familiarity, and then we act as if it is happening. So people are difficult because they're moving, they're responding, they're complex in their actions, and that's a kind of going live. You know, when you think about a relationship, when you practice how you're going to make up to your partner or how you're going to make it different this time, you're practicing with an image in your head that isn't moving or changing. Go live with that person, and now you have a whole other set of complexities to deal with that you can't really predict. And this is why people are difficult. People who meditate and go off into monasteries are able to live this aesthetic life, and that's admirable that they can do that. But I find that these people, as good as they are at managing themselves, when they get back into relationship, they're still bad at it because there's nothing as complicated as the interactive process with another person. Think of it as going live as opposed to it being on tape in review. There's a difference. And there's another thing, too. Our memories are influenced by our present state of mind, our feeling state. So memory is extremely plastic. How we feel about the past is often changed by how we feel at the moment. And so you and I together are going to be rotating through many different emotional and psychological states during a day. At any given time, we could run into each other at the wrong moment and really misappraise each other, really enter into a problem where if we were in another state of mind, we wouldn't. So there's a lot of complexities here for people to understand, all to say that people are basically doing the best they can, that I think there has to be some understanding of this and forgiving of this, that when we're in distress, we tend to, again, because it goes by so fast, we don't know how it got there, we don't know who's at fault, we just know we want it to stop. And we have a brain that makes things up. So I don't know why I did what I just did to you, Cheryl. And you asked me, why did you do that? And I don't know. But I'll make it up because I don't like not knowing, and you don't like not knowing. So I think people have to understand that that human relationships are complicated and that things aren't what they seem, and that there are certain skills that people can employ to help this process, such as knowing yourself, knowing where you came from, how you got this way, accepting yourself and taking responsibility for your reflexes. So, for instance, if I came from a family where there was not a lot of contact, physical contact, and everyone was expected to take care of themselves and not depend on anybody, I might have a hard time in adult relationship depending on someone or accepting you depending on me. But if I want to be in a relationship, I have to deal with that. I can't make that your problem. So that's one thing. The other is that if I'm in a relationship with you, I also have to learn you, kind of have your owner's manual and know where you come from, how you got this way, accept you as you are, and then learn how to work you. I mean, you're a different mind than I. You have a different brain than I have. I have to know how you work. I have to know how to get you to collaborate with me by using attraction and not fear, threat, or guilt. Does that make sense? And then the other is that we have to do a lot of things face-to-face, eye-to-eye. We have a lot of people now who are texting and, you know, communicating on Tumblr and email. And while all that is wonderful, it is a problem when a couple is not doing enough face-to-face, eye-to-eye communication, especially when in distress. We're visual animals, and if we are not dead on, dead center, looking into the eyes of our partner in close proximity, we are bound to make more errors. We pick up wrong messages. We make more mistakes, and it really causes a lot of problems. So I always tell people, you know, if you're driving in a car, don't bring up things like money, time, mess, sex, or kids, or anything emotionally stressful, because being at the side of each other is more threatening. It's better to pull over and go face-to-face, eye-to-eye. That's actually a much more efficient way to manage or to deal with stressful situations or conflict.
Well, that's so interesting. I'm sure a lot of people wish they had known that a long time ago.
Yes.
You know, how many of those conversations happened in cars that weren't very pleasant.
Well, it's because of the mechanics of the eye. We have a part of the eye called a fovea that sees the world in high definition, and it only sees it through a pinhole. Right. The rest of our eye, we're legally blind. And so if we're aside from, you know, to the side of each other and we're talking, we're more likely to trigger fear centers in the brain more often at the side than if we are face-to-face. So there's a real mechanical and neurological reason for it.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
So one of the most profound things I learned when I was in my psychotherapy practice working with relationships was that we think we're making a free will choice. You know, there's somebody,
right,
we fall in love. But little do we know that it's driven by all these underlying, unconscious, out of awareness needs and motives, going all the way back to these unmet needs as,
right,
children or infants.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this is where we get into so much trouble in relationship, in the untrained, unresourced relationship, because we don't really have the understanding and the knowledge of why we are reacting, or our partner may be reacting in ways that are stimulating these earlier wounds or earlier unmet needs. And that comes up all the time, right? That's
it comes up all the time. And I think this other thing too is that when we do partner up with someone, we are proxies for everybody who came before.
Mm.
And so it is normal and natural for us to begin to remember something that maybe doesn't belong to our partner, but is sounding like, looking like, and feeling like the same thing. As partners, we, I think, have a responsibility to step up to the plate and repair injuries for things we've never done, to step in and to, at key times, to be the parent that is necessary for our partners. Parenting doesn't stop with parenting. It continues in adult pair bonding. And so people might say, well, I don't want to be his mother. I shouldn't have to be her father. Well, yeah, you should if it's called for. Not all the time, but there are times when we need our partners to know what we need at that moment and to provide that function. That's what partners should do for each other because there is nobody else around. Their parents are either too old or passed away. These figures are not there. And so it makes sense that if you're going to pair bond, if you're going to commit yourself to someone, that the two of you agree to do things for each other that nobody else really wants to do. Very expensive things, like you know exactly what hurts me, you know exactly how to soothe me, you know exactly how to build up my ego. You know, I know how to do that with you. We know how to protect each other in public and private from the predatory world. You know, when you think of the biological nature of pair bonding, a lot of it has to do with being in a foxhole together and protecting one another from the environment, which is hostile. And so that's an important function. You know, you and I make agreements beyond our being attracted to each other or having things in common or, you know, even loving each other in a moment. We have agreements that protect each other from the environment and help us go through life with, you know, resources, safe and secure and energetic. That we do for each other, and nobody else can do that. We do it. But a lot of people really don't understand and can't answer the question why they're really together. What do they, you know, what do they serve? What purpose do they serve? And I think these are important questions to answer.
Well, I think very few people really ask themselves that question, and it is a fundamental question if a relationship will really thrive.
Yes.
In the years.
Yeah, it has to be there.
Yeah. Can we just tie in the stress that ensues in a relationship that doesn't understand the kinds of things we've been talking about and just are in a reactive mode, and how that desire for love and the stress that occurs when we can't get our needs met can impact us on a physiological level, or how our heart literally can be wounded?
Well, we are, you know, there have been many studies about this, and it gets confusing. You know, you're healthier, you're going to live longer if you're married, and that, of course, that idea is flawed.
I think that's only for men.
Yeah, for men. Well, it can be said if you are happily married, and happily then has to be defined. If you are in a relationship, and I'll define it myself, if you are in a relationship that is secure functioning, that is, these two people are operating under the rules of a primary relationship of where they are truly mutual, they are supportive of each other, they understand each other, they're not threatening to each other, and the relationship is absolutely unequivocally safe from being dissolved or destroyed. Those conditions have to be there. Under those conditions, people actually are more healthful. They have more resources because insecurity takes up a huge amount of resource. Insecurity, anxiety, not feeling tethered to another person takes up enormous resources. We know this with babies, infants, with toddlers, with teens, everybody. So that's a necessary condition. And then people can actually handle stress better. And the immune system operates better. The inflammatory system doesn't start to get out of whack. The cardiovascular system doesn't get out of whack. So we know that stress, ongoing stress, particularly the kind that is from an insecure relationship, can take a toll on the body. So chronic stress will cause heart disease, cause diabetes, can cause, you know, autoimmune disorders, inflammatory disorders. And so this is serious business. That's why we want to make sure that people are, you know, functioning in a way that's secure and not being dismissive, looking disgusted at each other with contempt. You know, all these expressions and attitudes wreak havoc on another person's immune system and heart. So, yes, it's really, really important to be connected to people and to be in a relationship, whether it's a love relationship or just having very, very close friends. But the quality of those relationships also must be secure. And otherwise, we still have a health problem there.
So, you know, when I was introducing you, we talked about the work that you do, and in your bio, you were saying that you are gaining a reputation for effectively treating couples formerly thought of as untreatable. What does that mean? What have you been doing? What have you taken on, and also what have you succeeded at achieving as a result of applying the work that you're doing with untreatable? What does untreatable mean?
Well, I think let me just give a background very quickly. Up until some years ago, couple therapy had a very bad reputation for being ineffective, and deservedly so. I think one of the reasons is that couple therapy as a process was retrofitted from other models of working with individuals and families. And so that was problem number one. Problem number two is that many people in our field dabbled in couple therapy. And this turns out to be a specialty. It's not something good if the therapist is not understanding it as a really distinct, almost unusual organism, what happens between two people. So, but then also, we've not had biological theories to support some of our psychological theories. And so now we have neuroscience, biology, understanding medicines and illnesses that help us deal with people who really have a hard time regulating each other. And by regulating, I'm talking about being able to put fires out with each other very fast. So when we talk about people who are really good regulators, co-regulators, these are people who are able to create exciting love states, amplify positives, quiet love states. They're able to amplify these positives together, and they're also very, very good at calming each other down when there's distress. They're able to foreshorten periods of distress. And so together as a regulatory team, they're really good. Contrast that with anything other than that. There can be people who are really very bad at this. They see threat everywhere. They react to each other very quickly. They're not doing it purposely. They truly see the other person as threatening.
Because of their past.
Because of their
past. How they were treated in their past.
How they were treated, and maybe mistakes that were unrepaired in the current relationship. Our memories are formed by intense experiences that last a long time. So if you and I have a negative experience, if I hurt you and don't repair it, that will go into long-term memory. If we have a great experience and I don't mess it up, that will go into long-term memory. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we have brains that are biased towards negative memories because of our survival instinct. We have to remember where we're hurt so we don't go there again. And so a lot of this has to do with poor repair. People either I don't notice that I did something to you and I do that repeatedly, or I don't care, or I act like I don't care. And this then accumulates a sense of threat and an anticipation of threat combined with our previous experience prior to the relationship, and now we've got a warring situation, right? And this is very easy for people to do, and I think it's so easy that people need to learn about how this works and how important it is. Repair, repair, repair. Pay attention. Your partner, the relationship, if you want the benefits of a secure functioning relationship, and there are lots, you have to put the relationship first. Your partner's state of mind has to be very important to you. And we live in a culture still that puts a lot of emphasis, too much, I think, on you take care of yourself, I take care of myself, and that's how it should be. We know biologically through attachment studies, it's much more efficient for me to regulate you and for you to regulate me. And that is still yet unknown in the greater population, that is the best way to do this. And so people are still operating under some false ideas that really don't work in this area of pair bonding.
So I think this is a good time to take a moment, take a break, and when we come back, Stan, I think a lot of people would benefit and appreciate learning more about some of those skills that they can start learning or letting them know what they need to be working on and where to go to get them. So so they can have the relationships we want. We all want relationships that are fulfilling and safe and loving. We just often don't know how to get there. So I know this is what you excel at. And, when we come back, you'll be able to share more with us on giving us some skills and tools. How's that sound? Like a plan?
Sounds great.
Okay. So we're going to take a short break. Don't go away because this is such an important conversation. I'm talking with Dr. Stan Patkin. We are exploring the nature of love and the neurobiology of healthy relationships. This is Dr. Cheryl Silman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Summon. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're having this really fascinating conversation with Dr. Stan Patkin, who is the author of a great audio series put out by Sounds True called Your Brain on Love, The Neurobiology of Healthy Relationships. He is also the author of Wired for Love, How Understanding Your Partner's Brain and Attachment Style Can Help You Diffuse Conflict and Build a Secure Relationship. And by the way, you can go to his website, stanpatkin, T-A-T-K-I-N, for more information. So, Stan, we were having this really interesting conversation. I do find the deeper esoteric side of relationships so profound. And and also what you're doing is helping to unravel this mystery and give us skills, resources, insight, understanding to what's going on so we can truly create a relationship. And it takes work. Like you said, other people are hard. there's no easy person out there.
Yeah.
And I love what you say. You may have your best friend at work, whatever, but try marrying them and see what happens.
Exactly.
So what have you found that you can share with us today that can be some practical skills or resources that people can begin to develop to help couples on their journey to creating true unconditional love and support for each other?
Well, the unconditional love part, I think, here is understanding what, I think really clarifying with each other or the partner you're going to be with, what's the point of us being together? Why be together beyond having children? And by the way, children benefit from their parents being in love, and they don't benefit from parents not being in love. So hopefully what comes first here is the love relationship, and that the children are invited to that party. So your partner, why are you guys together? What do you actually do for each other that you couldn't hire someone else to do? And not just for now, but in the long run, because this is a pact that people make, agreements, social contract, that protects them, that really builds sort of a structure over time that is life-supporting, that allows them to grow in that structure. And these are things that we do and things that we don't do. It's a cultural thing. These are the things that we do and things that we don't do. It might be something like we tell each other everything. And why do we tell each other everything? Well, it's not because we're reporting to each other, but because why on earth wouldn't we want another person, the person that we chose, to know everything about me, everything I know at least? Why wouldn't I want to do that? Why not be myself completely with this person? And so I think first is building an attitude, an idea of the purpose of being together. Are you in a foxhole together, or are you in separate foxholes? Do you put the relationship first, or do you throw the other under the bus when your work comes into focus, or when your children come into the room, or when your in-laws? These are very, very important things to have settled and understand. Do we protect each other in public and private? Are we the go-to people for everything? You're the person I call when I want to celebrate, or if I'm upset, I can text you. I can do all of that. You're not the only person, but you are the first person. You're the first to know about things, not the last. And so we're talking about an idea that's more mature and forward-thinking. As a social contract, why are we together? I would say that's the best and most important place to start, because no matter what techniques are employed, if people don't get the idea here that this system either survives together or dies together, no technique is going to help them. And unfortunately, many of us come to the table with models that, from our childhood, that are not truly mutual. You know, they're good for me, but they're not necessarily good for you. And when it comes down to it, I don't really care. These models aren't compatible with long-term relating because they're inherently unfair, unjust, and insensitive. And so I think people have to get their head straight about what model they're bringing to the relationship. Do I feel, I come from a culture where I don't have to tell you everything. I like secrets. I don't like to be bothered. Leave me alone. I'll come to you when I want. I want you in the house, but not in my room. I mean, these are, you know, it's a good gig if you can get it, but this is not really going to go well with the most people who want a close relationship. Or are you the kind of person who can't be alone, has to be attended to all the time, is angry whenever there's a separation and angry whenever there's a reunion, and only wants it one way? That's not very compatible either. So people don't have to be different people, but they have to understand that this system has to be fair, just, and mutually sensitive. And so there's an attitude here, I think, before we get into techniques. Does that make sense?
It does. And I guess my next question is this. Can a couple develop these new behaviors and resources and insights that let them support each other rather than operating out of old programmings that are attack or abusive or withdrawing? And
Basically a one-person system is what you're
right.
we're talking about, yeah.
Can they do that
yes.
through your books? Can they do that through your audio tapes? Or do they actually need to have a therapist to work with to help be that third-party neutral person to practice and go through these exercises?
I think that people who read the books or listen to the audios, I hear that they get a lot of help, and especially when they listen together. But it is hard because you and I are together. We're doing the best we can. We come from families that didn't put relationships first, and one-person systems, and we've really kind of come up against a wall, and we can't seem to go any further. I can't get you. I don't understand. You don't understand me. We come up with all sorts of theories about each other that are wrong, but are self-protective. I think then you need another model. Either that model comes from another person, some other experience of some kind, but there definitely has to be a sea change in the way we're understanding coupling. Now, here's an example. The police department and paramilitary organizations are able to enforce these cultural rules of partnership. You have to pay attention to your partner. Your partner is your life. You know, it's them, it's you against the world, that kind of thing. And people from all kinds of backgrounds are able to form these really strong attachment bonds, let's say with you know, police partnerships and police. Famously, these people become the go-to people for each other. They tell each other everything. They're loyal. They would take a bullet for each other. They're in the foxhole together because the culture demands it, and also the job demands it too, because they're truly, at risk in the environment. But these relationships become so tight that often their marriages suffer. The point here is that if they can do it, then everybody can do it. But there has to be some pressure put on the couple to think in this way. I think if we were in a war-torn area where we were being bombed, we probably wouldn't be thinking about whether we're each other's soulmates. We would be thinking in the right way. We'd be protecting each other, huddling together, managing together, strategizing together. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of this has to do with our culture. It's a problem right now that that people don't – because we're not really in any danger that we can think of. People don't see themselves as needing to huddle together, that their life really does depend on this solidarity. And unfortunately, it has to come from the outside if it isn't coming from the inside.
So what would be your advice to a couple, or at least one partner of that couple, who is feeling unloved, unappreciated, frustrated, and that other partner doesn't seem to want to cooperate with putting some of these strategies and new learnings into place? So you can't get cooperation, or it doesn't seem like there is.
If the idea here is secure functioning, therefore it's mutual. I do this for you, you do this for me. This is what we do for each other, this is what we don't do. If you aren't cooperating and you don't agree to that idea, we have no pact, I fire you. And I go and find somebody who will do that with me. That willingness to do that with me, I can be the most screwed up person in the world, and it doesn't matter. If I'm willing to play, and if I'm willing to do this with you, that's gold. And that's what we need in a partner, is a partner who's willing to do what is good for both of us. And those overriding ideas override, actually, personality. And so I think if one person is unwilling to put the relationship first, and this can be misunderstood, by the way, by people, but here, good for me, good for you. If people are unwilling to play in that game, then one person, the one who's unhappy, if they really believe in this, should get out and find somebody who's willing to play.
Because you have a roadblock. You can't achieve what you want to achieve in that pair bonding if you don't have a cooperative partner.
Absolutely. If you're unhappy and I'm not taking that up right away, not only is it bad for me because I have an unhappy partner, but also it's an act of bad faith. So I have got to care about your state. I have got to care about what makes you unhappy because we're tied together. Where you go, I go. If I go down, you go down. And so it's folly to not do that. If somebody is not willing to take that seriously, they don't get it, and they should be dropped.
Which is, of course, no easy thing. We're so tied in on so many levels, you know, that it's terrifying to...
It is terrifying. Because, like the song, breaking up is hard to do.
Yeah.
But here we're talking, I'm trying to change the perspective here from soulmate and love and romantic love to real brass tacks here in terms of biology, happiness, security. We have to, as human animals, we absolutely depend on unequivocal safety and security with one person at least. Otherwise, we do not function well in the world. We do not. And if you and I are not feeling secure that the relationship will exist tomorrow, both of us will be acting very strange. We'll both be auditioning all the time. We'll both be behaving in a way that's unattractive and maybe not very nice. Because people who are feeling insecure are not nice. They can't develop further. They have no resources to do much. It's a sorry state. So, if nothing else, I think people should really take this piece home. Safety and security between you and me, Cheryl, if we were a couple, and us, giving each other absolute assurances that our relationship, no matter what, will exist tomorrow. We'll fight, we'll disagree, but we are going to make sure that we're both okay at every turn. That is going to allow us to do more, be more than we ever could possibly do on our own. And it's absolutely necessary for physical health. So I think this business of having somebody who's willing to do this with you and is a willing partner is the most important thing, not whether they are the most psychologically healthy person or not, because we all have problems. This is not about changing your personality. This is about understanding the purpose of coupling.
I think that just to complete our conversation, because it's so interesting, but as we learn more useful strategies so we can move together in a safe way in the world,
right.
Then maybe this is where your work really comes in, because then you actually are changing your brain.
You are, yes.
And that is so profound, because if you can change the way your brain fires,
yes.
You change the way it wires, as they say, which means you perceive things differently and you heal so much of that which has wounded us in the past.
Absolutely. If we are if we're comrades together, if we are in each other's corner, absolutely, because we vow it, because we can, we decide we can do this. We can really do wonders. I mean, I've seen it in my life. I see it in many other people's lives. Mm-hmm. This is why we pair bond. Couples do better together than individuals do alone. It's just always been that way. Because it's our biological heritage. That's how we're wired. And our brain does change according to our relationships. Relationships are the best medicine. You know, if a relationship is working out well, it's the best antidepressant, the best anti-anxiety agent, the best sleep medication. Of course, it's, you know, if it's working out bad, then it's also causing depression, anxiety, and sleep problems. So, you know, it can cut either way, and hopefully we've given a roadmap as to how people can start to move it in the way that makes sense for our, for how we are actually wired as animals, and not what we think we should be, but how we are.
And that's why I love your work. I think it's so profound because it's really helping us to heal and evolve and experience and stay in the place of I guess you can say love, but safety. That's that place where you feel safe.
Yes.
You can open up so you can be who you are, and we're amazing things happen when we're in that place.
Amazing
that
things do, yeah.
Amazing things do. Yeah.
We're hurt by people, and we can only be healed by people. You can't get healed in a cave or a book. There is an idea, still goes around, you know, you have to love yourself first before you can really love another, and that's absolutely untrue. It doesn't make any sense developmentally. We are loved first. That's how we learn how to love. We were found by parents who want to find the baby in us before we find ourselves. Everything happens from the outside in first. And so these things don't happen in a vacuum. We learn to love another by being in a relationship with another and failing and mourning and and regretting and then doing it again, better. We learn how to do this, and we learn how to love ourselves through the quality of love we give another. They're intertwined. So for those people who think they have to go off somewhere and practice this before they get into a relationship, they can't. They have to do it.
Oops. I guess we'll just have to wait for a relationship to come around then. But the other thing I just want to say is even if a relationship seems to be functioning,
yes,
it can always improve.
Oh yes, always. Oh my gosh, we're incredibly creative, animals. Our brains are able to create novelty, and you know, this is a problem that a lot of people feel. Oh my gosh, I feel bored with my partner. They're not novel. I need something new, someone new. But we can create novelty with each other, and people who are secure functioning know this, and they know how to do it. They use one another properly. They spend time gazing into each other's eyes. They do things that are novel, like see new things, meet new people together. They do things, and so it is an ever increasing matter of complexity that two people can develop as individuals in ways that are astounding. But again, the idea, the spirit of the idea here, has to be in place. And a lot of people, I think, still don't have the framing in mind of why a love relationship should be there, why it exists in the modern world. And people don't have that roadmap. But again, people might want to think about not so much romance, but true partnership, true loyalty, where people are absolutely trusted people. Because their lives depend on it, because they do it, because it's a necessary condition. Not all these relationships are romantic, but all of them of this kind are very important.
Well, I want to thank you for all the research you've done to put a system together that can really help people do this kind of healing and create what we're all yearning for, which is a wonderful
tether.
Love. Yeah, tethered in a good way. And I recommend people get your audio series, which I'm just going to tell people the name of right now, Your Brain on Love, The Neurobiology of Healthy Relationships, with my guest today, Dr. Stan Tatkin. Is that audio series available on your website?
It is. For people who want to get CEUs also, they can download it from the website. It's also available on audible.com mm-hmm. and through mm-hmm. Sounds True. And may I make a plug for a nonprofit very quickly?
Sure. Absolutely.
Tracy and I are involved in a nonprofit organization just recently launched. Harville Hendricks and his lovely wife, Helen Hunt, spearheaded this organization called Relationships First. And a bunch of us so-called couple experts are involved in this movement. Dan Siegel and his wife, John Gottman, Julie Gottman, Sue Johnson, the names go on and on. We've all gotten together in with this mission, 50-year mission, to change the course of relationships and to start to put people on a track that I'm talking about here. And if people want to join, there's nothing to join, just go to relationshipsfirst.org and say, I'm in. And there are a lot of wonderful people involved in this, Alanis Morissette, a lot of entertainment people. We all believe in the same thing. This is a science-based, not religious, not political movement to try to put us back on course.
Well, heal relationships and you begin to heal the world.
Right, yes.
Right? It's all about relationships.
Yep.
So this has been such a pleasure, Stan. I really appreciate your time and, again, the wonderful work that you are doing. And I certainly encourage people to, you know, get the audio series, play it with your partner, and begin the journey to create your ideal relationship. Stan Tatkin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Cheryl.
And to all my listeners, thank you for being with us today. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. My guest today was Dr. Stan Tatkin. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.